Welcome to the Fermentation Speaker Series from the Center for Human Microbiome Studies at Stanford University School of Medicine. I am Aliza Caffrey, a graduate student in the Sonnenberg Lab here at Stanford.
I'm David Zilbert, a chef, food scientist, and author specializing in fermentation.
I'm Justin Sonnenberg, professor of microbiology and immunology at Stanford, and my lab studies the gut microbiome.
Our goal is to open up conversation around the current understanding and knowledge in the fermented food research space, and to define and promote future fermented food and health projects. Sourdough is technically a SCOBY. It's a mix of yeast and bacteria, and it's not just Saccharomyces cerevisiae and Fructolactobacillus sanfranciscensis, but it's a number of different acetic acid and lactic acid bacteria and yeast. And when we think of sourdough or wine or any fermented food that has both yeast and bacteria, we tend to think of them as getting along. They're cooperating in some way. But there are actually different ways in which we describe microbial interactions when naturally occurring in co-cultures. The first is competition, which is a relationship where species contend for resources. The second is mutualism, which is a relationship where both species may benefit. And there's commensalism, which is a relationship where one species benefits and the other will remain unaffected.
Yeah, and I think these interactions are super fascinating. They're pervasive in basically all microbial communities and basically all interactions between organisms in general. But certainly when you start looking at microbes, you see these sorts of interactions where there's warfare between microbes. They're trying to kill each other. They're competing for resources that are limited, trying to grow quickly, but then benefiting from one another in certain cases as well. And it's what's playing out every time we ferment food, which I think is super interesting. And it really points to the importance of what sort of community you're starting with, what sort of microbes you have that are seeding your culture, and kind of gets to some of the concepts we've talked about throughout this podcast, starter cultures, backslopping, conditions for salinity and temperature really driving which microbes are successful and kind of win out. And I think to a good friend of our lab, Kevin Foster at Oxford, his lab studies bacterial warfare in different contexts. And they've created this really beautiful game, a modeling game. It's basically like a video game. You can just go to your browser. If you type in gut wars and Foster Oxford, this should come up. And it's an interface where you can actually seed a model microbial community with different microbes that have different capacities for killing each other or different levels of competition or cooperation, and then actually watch the microbes grow graphically on the screen and watch them kill each other or benefit from one another. And it's really interesting to just see these microbial community dynamics based on the starting conditions that you've defined. So I encourage everybody to go out there and just, try this for themselves. It's fun and pretty illuminating for the dynamics.
They are so dynamic. I mean, I recently came across a term that has a pretty strict definition in microbiology, but I just love poetically, like if you just dwell on it for a second and think about it and blow it up, it kind of encompasses all of fermentation. If you kind of build that bridge in between microbes and macrobes, but it's called syntrophy, which kind of sounds familiar if you're familiar with symbiosis, but it is syn, the Greek for together, and trophy, Greek for eating or nourishment. And generally, the pretty strict definition, Justin, you were mentioning this a while back, but, it's almost considered in microbiology as like an obligate interdependency, where one organism produces a metabolite that is absolutely like a non-starter for another microorganism that depends on it for its nutrients, for its energy, for its metabolism. And that perfectly describes something like a SCOBY, which is sourdough, which is kombucha. You have an initial organism producing something that, if you want to talk about warfare, was an exclusionary molecule. Think about the metabolites produced in kombucha. You have ethanol, which is a sledgehammer for microbes, and acetic acid, which, if you want to keep life out, lower the pH. but somehow they've learned to live together. Somehow, you know, after so much time spent together, the microbes that evolved to live in harmony with one another use these things to their advantage, either by excluding other microbes that aren't part of their community or by directly feeding off of each other. So it is fascinating. And even in my work, I've even come across, you know, yeast that have learned to metabolize lactic acid, which is, you know, directly relevant for sourdough starters. But, you know, all of this talk of interaction, you know, today's guest, I think, is the perfect person to speak to that. And so we have to kind of ask ourselves, what can sourdough teach us as a model about competition and microbial fitness, both good and bad?
Today's guest is Dr. Chantal Switchko. Dr. Switchko is a postdoc in the lab of Dr. Leonid Krugliak, where she studies mutualism in yeast and bacteria fermentation communities. Chantal, thanks so much for joining us. Last time I saw you was close to 2 years ago, so it's going to be really exciting to get into what you're working on now. You're a postdoc, but your grad work was on mouse genetics and models of metabolic syndrome like non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. So how do you go from, you know, studying metabolic syndrome in mice to looking at yeast and bacterial interactions?
Yeah, that's a great question. For me, fundamentally, I'm a geneticist. Genetics kind of became my chosen viewpoint of the world, given that genetics is pretty close to as close to a causal mechanism in biology as possible, right? So it's something that goes from DNA out, and from that framework, I'm able to look at traits as a result of genetic changes and evolutionary changes on DNA. So that was always kind of my key interest. So genetics has always been this like framework. And in conjunction, you know, the kitchen was my first lab growing up. I watched a lot of Food Network, and that was kind of the first area of experimentation. And so, you know, I majored in biology. I got into heart disease because my family was afflicted by it. So there was personal interest there. And I ended up just being really interested in genomics. So again, this idea of how DNA leads to traits that we can study. You know, I grew up in San Diego and spent a lot of time in the craft beer scene. So all these factors kind of came together by the time I was finishing my PhD. So like I said, I was working with metabolic diseases, or obesity, fatty liver disease, heart disease, and I was working in mice. So in the way that there's genetic variation between us as humans, and in the way that there's genetic variation between different breeds of dogs, in mice, there's actually quite amount of significant genetic variation, which leads to different susceptibilities to things like obesity and heart disease and liver disease. So I was using this genetic variation in mice to study these traits. But then at the end of my PhD, COVID happened, and I was not able to go into the lab, able to go into the vivarium and, you know, do my experiments. And it just so happened that Ben Wolf's paper on the crowdsourced microbiome profiling of sourdough starters had come out. And like many people, was stuck in my kitchen and itching to do experiments, to do, you know, something hands-on. And I had seen this paper where he had done the metagenomic sequencing of all these starters people had sent in. And I remember specifically seeing the ITS sequencing, which is the fungal profiling of these starters. And overwhelmingly, the predominant yeast species is Saccharomyces cerevisiae, or baker's yeast. And in genetics, it's really important to have, you know, model organisms, like I said, so you're working with mice or humans. And yeast is another one of these really classic model organisms in genetics. And so I saw that, and my genetics brain immediately just went, well, yeah, that's the species, but there's also probably genetic variation there that we're not really, you know, thinking about or double clicking on. And I just realized I was in a very unique position to be able to pursue that question a little bit further. And, you know, with my interest in food and like craft beer, right? So that I had encountered White Labs in San Diego, which is it's a yeast company that's, you know, was also started by a PhD in molecular biology that essentially focuses on the genetic variation between different strains of beer yeast. So all those frameworks kind of came together. And in the context of sourdough, right, where sourdough communities are usually one yeast and some bacteria. And so the fact that we kept seeing Saccharomyces cerevisiae with all of these other bacteria kind of made me think about how did we get to this community evolutionarily and to fermented foods in general? What is it that drives yeast and bacteria to cohabitate and to potentially benefit from being in the same environment? And I use genetics and evolution and genetic variation within yeast to kind of poke at this question space.
You know, I think you've mentioned Saccharomyces cerevisiae a few times. That, of course, is the common yeast that everybody's familiar with that you can buy for, you know, just baking bread. It's clear based on your opening comments there that there's just even within that species, huge genetic variation and a lot of different strains. But there's also just a lot of other yeast out there. And, you know, if you think about wild fermented wine and of course, kombucha with SCOBYs, and then of course, sourdough can have all sorts of things in it. So I'm wondering if you could just talk a little bit about why Saccharomyces cerevisiae has become so popular for food applications. And, you know, is this historical? Is this something based on its properties? Maybe both from like a kind of lay, but also maybe a genetics perspective. And then what are the varieties of other things out there that maybe the field should be thinking about or looking into for potential?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I will recognize I'm very biased towards cerevisiae. And, you know, there is a historical precedent for this. So this goes all the way back to Louis Pasteur and his, you know, discovery of cells and of, you know, micro living organisms. And so he essentially discovered yeast cells while he was understanding alcoholic fermentation in beer. So, you know, after the Franco-Prussian War, he was working for kind of the French beer industry, trying to reduce their reliance on German-produced beer. And essentially, one of his early theses was the diseases of beer, you know, unintentional spoilage. And so being able to understand how to reproducibly make beer independently from the German tradition of making beer, that was what led to the discovery of yeast. I feel very proud to be able to be like, you know, without yeast, we wouldn't have been able to discover, you know, the basis of cellular life. And on top of that, so why yeast, cerevisiae in particular? One, I think from that standpoint, it's the precedent of it. In the era of like genetics in the 50s, you tended to have model organism consortiums. It was like battle of the everyone's favorite organism, right? So you had your like fruit fly camp and everyone that was really interested in promoting that. And it just so happened that everyone kind of corralled around cerevisiae as their favorite microorganism. But the reason that it's so interesting and popular is because it, you know, it's unicellular in a way that we might think bacteria is unicellular, but genetically cerevisiae and yeast are very similar to humans. So they have a nucleus in the way that, you know, higher order mammals have a nucleus. And so for that reason alone, it makes it very attractive to study because they are, you know, they replicate in 90 minutes and they, you know, can grow in liquid, you can freeze them. So they're a way to study eukaryotes. So, you know, kind of nucleus containing organisms for our own self-interest as humans, it's a very relevant model to be able to study things like how DNA replicates, how DNA is regulated, how genes are turned off and on, and how genetic variation affects traits in a way that's relevant to our own interest in genotypes and phenotypes. And the second part of your question, so if different aspects of yeast that might be interesting, one within the realm of beer yeast, there is the whole lineage of Saccharomyces cerevisiae. And one of the kind of clear dichotomies that's well known is this idea between beer yeast or ale yeast and lager yeast. So top fermenting versus bottom fermenting, which have different preferences with regard to temperature and fermentation time. And what I think is interesting is that what we know now to be lager yeast is actually a hybrid of Saccharomyces cerevisiae and an older strain, Saccharomyces eubionis. And so a lot of this talk and what I'll probably talk about today is just how evolution kind of pushes the genomes of yeast to best fit their environment and why they're so good at adapting, you know, relative to our very complex being. But outside of the cerevisiae and Saccharomyces, there are some really interesting yeast there in the industry. There particularly like in the biopharmaceutical industry and now like the alternative protein industries, there are yeasts called Pichia pastoris, and these are protein producing yeasts. So these are yeasts that can be engineered. They're a little bit more efficient. They don't produce as much byproduct in the fermentation vessels as, say, Saccharomyces does. Another yeast called Eurovia lipolytica, which is very similar in terms of its ability to input carbon sources that are not usually used by yeast, but also its ability to make fats. So it's kind of like needs matching with regard to the right yeast vehicle for whatever it is you want them to produce. And Saccharomyces cerevisiae is really good at taking sugars or carbon sources like starches and essentially turning them into alcohol, carbon dioxide, things that we normally associate with fermentation. But there are yeasts out there that are better suited for things like producing, you know, insulin in vats that we can now, you know, use to serve the human population. And we're only kind of scratching the surface as we're discovering more of these properties and more of these species.
I think yeast maybe gets like the worst rap in all of biology or microbiology for having like genericized trademark syndrome, where you say yeast, you're like, oh yeah, sure, that's, yeah, in my bread, you know, I can buy that in the grocery store. I'm reading a book right now on like the history of oxygen on Earth by Nick Lane from Oxford. Great, great chemist and great writer. And he blew my mind when he was talking about this kind of rewriting of the script of, you know, early life forms needing to be to drive their metabolism via fermentation. And he talks about how yeast used to be an aerobic organism, but then evolved to prefer anaerobic metabolism. And within that little explanation, he showed kind of a chart of like yeast's genetic lineage and like how far back in time some of these, you know, lines branched off. And we're talking about like 500 million years ago. Do you see splits in some of those names that you just mentioned? Which is really funny because you talk to anyone in general, like, oh yeah, it's yeast. It's like, oh yeah, it's all related. But it's like further back than we are from the dinosaurs, which is kind of wild.
That's truly crazy. It's a very good point. That's amazing. You know, I think the point you made about yeast serving as little model humans is a really interesting one. I did some work as an undergraduate when I was at UC Davis in a yeast lab. And I assumed joining the lab that we were going to be working on beer and bread, you know, knowing very little about scientific research at that point. And actually being from Northern California, we ended up isolating yeast from Sierra Nevada. It was before they filtered it and actually brewed beer with the yeast from Sierra Nevada beer. But the research in the lab was all focused on, you know, the secretory pathway and all these really fundamental aspects of cell biology that do extend over the past, you know, 500 million years and are common to all eukaryotes, and really interesting research. And there's a ton of it still going on where we're learning fundamental things. So that's a really great point that even when you're studying microbes that are relevant to fermentation, you're learning things that are fundamental to, you know, all eukaryotes and certainly humanity. I'm wondering, just as an example, you mentioned this kind of niche filling or kind of phenotypes that stem off of genotypes that have been selected. If you could just as an example, talk about the yeast that are used for baking bread now and what they've been kind of optimized for and what that means in terms of what they do and what's happened to their genomes.
Yeah, this has been an area that I think about quite deeply. One, bread making is not a natural phenotype, right? Like there is no benefit for yeast to be able to leaven bread in the wild. It is a domesticated phenotype that we as humans have selected for, right? So especially in one of the areas where we see this most clearly is industrial yeast, like industrial baking yeast, right? And there's a very clear lineage between, say, the home sourdough starter that you produce and the yeast that are being used in the bakery. And that is simply due to what is being expected of the yeast. So in the industrial bakery sense, you're proofing bread three times a day. So there is no lag. It is constant production of bread. And when I mean production of bread, what the yeast are doing is rising bread, right? It's creating the CO2 that creates the fluffiness and levity and lightness of bread that we come to know canonically. And so that is, with that kind of container, that is what the yeast have been selected for, is this ability to create CO2 very rapidly. And not only just create CO2, but they have to use what's the energy sources that are at hand. And in particular, bread is almost always wheat derived. And the main sugar in a lot of grains is maltose. So your industrial bread yeasts are very good at breaking down maltose and creating lots and lots of CO2. And so this happens in quite interesting ways. Particularly, one of the easiest ways for yeast to adapt is, you know, so there are different types of genetic variation. And the ones that tend to have really big effects are things like chromosomal duplication. So these are, or regions of the genome that get duplicated so that they have multiple copies so that they're able to really crank up production. This is relevant because there are genes that relate to the metabolism of maltose. There are literally enzymes that are encoded in some yeast that can break down maltose into further fermentable sugars. So by having multiple copies of these maltase genes, you're really able to be good at breaking down maltose and creating CO2. And the yeast that do this really efficiently are going to be the ones that are selected from batch to batch, because, you know, they're able to utilize sugar to reproduce and to create CO2. So that's one example of kind of an industrial yeast phenotype that we have identified selection for.
Excellent. And maybe before we move on, because I know that another weird thing that's happened with yeast that we buy from the store and use in bread making, if it's not sourdough, is that it exists in kind of a isolated environment. It's you know, not working with other microbes that it would normally be found with. And there's a whole interesting part of your research, and I think evolution, that is interested in these sorts of interactions. But
it's not very good at competing against other, or surviving against other kind of naturally occurring microbes.
Totally, yeah. So and this was mind blowing to me, because when I started baking with sourdough, I went to a sourdough workshop up in San Francisco, and I was talking to the person who was running the workshop, and I said, you know, the problem with my kitchen is sometimes I do things with commercial yeast, and then I have this sourdough starter, and I'm really worried I'm going to contaminate my sourdough starter with this commercial yeast that must be just a beast and will take over everything. And she said, don't worry about it. She said that commercial yeast won't stand a chance if it gets into your sourdough starter, which was kind of mind-blowing to me.
Right. Yeah. And that comes from the fact that it was evolved, like you mentioned, in isolation without any other, you know, interactions with microbes. And so its use, and you see this with laboratory yeast as well. Like, you know, these very domesticated yeasts are not good at interacting with other things in their environment.
Yeah, very interesting. So, but before we move on to kind of the interactions part of this, maybe you could just talk about Saccharomyces cerevisiae tools, advantages, disadvantages in terms of like research and things you can do with it in your studies.
Yeah. So like I said, I study genetic variation. So a lot of what we do in the lab is either create genetic variation by crossing yeasts. So imagine, you know, two genetically diverse parents having 1,000 children. And so every time you have sexual reproduction, you get chromosomal shuffling, right? So you get meiosis through genetic recombination, and we can track traits that go along with this kind of genetic shuffling. So that's one tool that we have, and we can, it's called quantitative trait loci mapping, or QTL mapping. It's kind of a bread and butter genetics tool to be able to use meiosis as a natural process to shuffle these things. Another thing that we do is that we use genetic engineering. So things like CRISPR screens that can systematically knock out genes to be able to kind of assess genome-wide which genes are important for certain functions. So this is like a library of, you know, tens of thousands of different pieces of DNA that correspond to the yeast genome. And we can basically target one by one the different areas of the genome and see how that affects function. So that's kind of related to the molecular cloning aspect of genetics. And lastly, we also have a large collection of yeast. So one of our collaborators has collected over 1,000 different strains of cerevisiae. So this is, they go out into the wild, or they get from different collections, 1,000 plus different genetically diverse strains. And so we have them that we can culture and then use for phenotyping. But working with 1,000 samples is, you know, not necessarily the easiest physically to do. So we have a lot of tools that allow us to do high throughput things. So things like pipettes that have 96 or 384 pipette heads that you can use to move liquid at once. Or we have liquid handling robots that can do, you know, plate to plate transfers. And we have robots that will pin from, you know, dozens of agar plates. And so being able to do things at scale is really important. And you know, so that's kind of how you work on the population level of genetics. Other things that are related, which are pretty similar in microbiology, are being able to culture the yeast, right? So having the right media. So this, you know, for my work, includes things like sourdough media or grape juice, which becomes wine media, or sometimes milk media if you're doing kind of more cheese fermentations. And so being able to get the right growth conditions, which, you know, especially studying these interactions so kind of removed in the lab, the input and context of growth is really important to the phenomena that we're studying. So being able to kind of modify the nutrients, and so having, you know, the right ammonium source, the right carbon source, the right amount of oxygen in your incubators are all really important. And then lastly, you know, it's a genetics lab, so being able to sequence things is really important. That's most of the data that we generate. And so we have both low capacity, you know, kind of in benchtop sequencers that we have, and then we have large scale, you know, billions of reads sequencers that allow us to kind of generate these data sets. And so that across the board, I'd say those are the tools of a yeast geneticist that studies population genetics.
I want to jump in here and kind of talk about the focus of your project, which is mutualism, which is about playing well with others. Can you quickly describe that for us?
Yeah. So this is kind of an ecological concept that has to do with, and I'm going to use the word fitness as a geneticist. So fitness is, you know, like, if you think about Darwin, survival of the fittest, how well, you know, an organism can adapt or survive in its environment. And I think we talked about this once, David, about how all microbial life is essentially warfare. And so a lot of the interactions between microbes is usually competition. You know, and you look at yeast, the reason that they produce ethanol is to be able to kill anything around it that's not able to tolerate ethanol so that they have advantage. So that's an example of how certain evolutionary mechanisms can increase a yeast's fitness. So there's competition, which is kind of basically like every microbe for themselves. And then mutualism is kind of the opposite. It's almost this like symbiotic relationship where there is a exchange of, it's usually nutrients, but there's some kind of advantage from having another species present, say with the yeast, that increases the fitness of either one or both parties. So it's that the presence of the other species is important to the survival of say the yeast.
I think that's a great explanation. And now this, as it pertains to yeast and cerveza specifically, it seems like, at least in wild fermentation, it does like to buddy it up. Like if we could talk about mutualism as being this kind of fitness enhancing tool, I have this kind of meta view of fermentation, and that, you know, the recipes that some of these microbes find themselves within speak to us so much that, you know, we want to propagate them, and we go to great lengths to build, you know, giant three-story tall fermenters to house yeast to chew our grapes and you know, munch on our malt. But, you know, across the board we have scobies, we have symbiotic colonies of bacteria and yeast. And this is kind of a thought that I had. I don't know if I was asked a question from an audience when I was doing a presentation or when I was writing the Nova Guide to Fermentation, but it occurred to me, it's like, oh, wait, but sourdough bread is a SCOBY just like kombucha is a SCOBY. It's a colony. You have yeast working right alongside bacteria. They've been adapted to each other. And that was kind of like the first link. And then I realized, well, there's this saying in the kitchen from my days as a sous chef where I'd be like hounding my cooks to clean down. You know, if you don't look for dirt, you won't find it. And now that I work with microbes, I kind of have reversed my stance on competition. And I'm like, if you don't look for mutualism, you won't find it, because it seems like it's everywhere. It seems like in any ferment where you actually do a metagenomic analysis,
you'll see bacteria doing a lot of work, and then you'll be like, well, what are those yeast cells doing as well? Like, why did those pop up? Can you kind of talk about this range of mutualism and why fungi and single cells, you know, eukaryotes like to buddy up with prokaryotes so much in all of these foods?
I'm going to start with how we study mutualism in the lab. And to be candid, forcing microorganisms to have mutualistic interactions in the lab is actually quite difficult. And this comes down to being able to produce the right kind of environment. And you usually see the strongest effects of mutualism when you have environments that are depleting in nutrients. So one of the strongest factors that can promote mutualism between species is things like nitrogen depletion. So, we have definitively been able to show that bacteria will exchange nitrogen with yeast in environments where nitrogen is low. So we'll put that in one box on for one second. But then we're interested in kind of how does this occur in natural, fermented foods in these environments. And when you think about, sourdough and dough or wine, there's no scarcity of nutrients there, right? So it is, in my understanding, a proverbial feast of carbon source, of nitrogen, of basically anything anyone would want. So initially that community is just is happenstance. They just happen to be there. They have their preferred food, and no one is really fighting for nutrients at that point. So initially, it could just be that we were both carried on the grapes. This is both our preferred food, and we're okay. But things like sourdough, I think, start to get a little bit more interesting because then you have bacteria that can break down things like starches, which are not yeast's preferred food. So starches, are long chains of sugars, and yeast prefer the simple sugars to be able to ferment. So there you start to see things like bacteria being able to break down starches and invert sugars so that they become more accessible for the yeast to then ferment. So much of the mutualism is just, I think, due to chance, the fact that, that you happen to create this waste product or this byproduct of something that you're normally doing that benefits another organism, or they happen to evolve faster that they can actually use that, is how these relationships start. But it really spans a great amount of dependence from, we just happen to be in the same environment, to I really need this very essential nutrient, and you you are the only thing around that is able to make that, and kind of every other relationship in between.
It's funny that you call it chance. I'm like, all of evolution is chance. But it is a good point. It's like nature makes do with what she's got, with who she's got around her. Do you see any like key players that keep popping up alongside Cervacea, whether it's genera or specific species that it has like a buddy system with more than most?
For sure. I think that the best friends of fermentation are, Cervacea, your yeast, and lactic acid bacteria. They're in everything. Almost every fermented food has some relationship between yeast and lactic acid bacteria. So you look at sourdough, and the predominant and kind of most iconic lactic acid bacteria is Lactobacillus sanfranciscensis, which is also a very, very interesting lactic acid bacteria, because in the realm of lactic acid bacteria, it is not very fast. It is not very, it's kind of specific, but it shows up across the board, in these very old starters and at high proportions, and you're just like, you're not supposed to be, the winner in this environment. You have things like Lactobacillus plantarum or Brevis that are very good, very fast, can adapt. But when you look at these really old starters, it's almost always dominated by Sanfranciscensis, and you're like, how? Which I think is a whole nother mystery aside. And then in wine, the lactic acid bacteria, Enococcus aenae, which is responsible for, malolactic fermentation, which is, the softening and affecting the texture of wine. That, again, that's another key example within a particular style of ferment that you have this pairing between yeast and lactic acid bacteria. And then you mentioned kombucha, which I think is kind of a the most different of the three between sourdough wine and kombucha. And I think that's mostly due to the fact that kombucha tends to be more aerobic than sourdough and wine fermentations. So it's known that Cervisia is not the predominant yeast in kombucha. It's either a Candida species or Brettanomyces. And in addition to lactic acid bacteria, the kind of key feature of kombucha is acetic acid bacteria. So these are bacteria that take ethanol, require oxygen, and produce acetic acid. And kind of the key element between yeast and these bacteria species is that they're acid producing, right? And that's the key kind of element of food preservation of I don't know, gastronomic experience is these organic acids that make things delicious to eat. And, you know, I think we've evolved to appreciate the acidity of these kinds of foods.
Just to quickly follow up where you mentioned Onukaka Soeni, my understanding is that, you know, as you said, with malolactic fermentation, which is the secondary stage of wine production, you first start off, right, with this increase in yeast and alcohol production in the primary fermentation, and then the relative abundance of the yeast decreases, and that's when you see an increase in the lactic acid microbe. Is that temporal separation the same in sourdough? Or do you always have yeast and bacteria growing at a similar rate at the same time?
It's very similar to what happens in sourdough. So there have been studies that look at the ecological succession within sourdough, and also just by nature of cellular replication, you know, bacteria can reproduce much faster than yeast. And so you're going to see the bacteria almost growing at first, and then the yeast a little bit lagging behind, which in the case of wine is inverse, but I think that's due to the increased amount of malic acid that comes from the initial fermentation.
Now this touches a lot on my current work with Christian Hansen, soon to be a new company called Novo Nessus. I'm now part of the Novo team. How do you think about the differences in diversity between, you know, these commercialized industrial workhorses and things that you might either find in the wild or in kind of that kind of blurry in between point where you have something that's been nurtured in, say, a home kitchen or like a small fermentary for a while? How do you look at that gradient and understand the diversity of yeast, you know, it under that framework?
Yeah, I tend to think of it at the level of like selection pressure and the amount of evolutionary like strain that a yeast is undergoing. So, you know, I think for the, again, this kind of comes back to genotype phenotype relationships. So the more extreme the phenotype that you're trying to select for, the more genetic changes you're going to experience. And again, this is on a spectrum. And what's interesting is about the yeasts and the strains that tend to evolve in these industrial environments is, you know, their genotypes basically prevent them from being really adaptive. So where I think that the difference is that the ones that are extremely domesticated kind of reach a tipping point, and we were talking about this with the baker's yeast, right? That they're no longer able to kind of interact well with kind of natural occurring environments. And so with things like a lab strain, you know, we have evolved them to do, they're terrible yeast to work with outside of, you know, studying cellular replication and all these things, because they don't flocculate. So things like when you're brewing yeast, when your fermentation's done, the yeast flocculate and they drop out of solution, and then you can clarify your beer. We have bred that out of lab strains. They are not able to flocculate because when they stick together in the tube, it makes it really hard for them to study. And so, and that often is related to loss, genetic loss of, so the more extreme phenotypes that we're selecting for, the more shit we start losing from their genome. And it, at that point, it's very difficult to put them back. And so I think that's kind of what characterizes these very domesticated strains, basically how well are you able to take them back out and put them in something that would be considered more of a natural state? And they do really, really poorly versus, you know, ones that are maybe in the home environment, they're fluctuating a little bit because maybe the flower changes, the temperature changes, the water changes, the microbes on your hand changes. So they're adapting a little bit versus very constrained, repetitive environments that are strongly selecting for traits in kind of in these industrial spaces. And also things like you mentioned, so like lab strains some of them don't do aerobic respiration very well. So, you know, yeast have this ability to switch from fermentation to aerobic respiration. So non-oxygen to oxygen usage. And in certain conditions that is desired or not desired. So, you know, there are some strains that have completely lost their mitochondria. They're called petite strains of yeast and they basically have no mitochondria. So they're completely unable to do any kind of aerobic respiration. So, you know, you can get phenotypes that are that extreme as well.
There's a thread here where it's like if like stress breeds resilience, where we're being thrown to the winds of chance and, you know, being exposed to competition and pathogens gets you to be flexible and malleable with your own genome.
Yeah. And so I think you asked about how we can identify these strains. So we do whole genome sequencing. So we are able to kind of, the yeast genome is relatively compact. We can read through from beginning to end all of their chromosomes and map them against, you know, known catalogs of variation. And so the way that we identify new strains is basically, can we identify new genetic variation that we haven't seen before? Can we put this evolutionarily in like a phylogenetic tree, which, you know, arranges these strains based off their genetic differences and similarities and then characterize them that way?
All of this attention being paid to yeast diversity, and I know it's a great model organism, and it also has a huge commercial interest. You know, I'm sure Le Lamond loves to hear about news coming out of your lab for their own uses and things like that. But what are the broader implications of some of the learnings in your work and how does all this kind of spill back into society in a meaningful way?
Yeah, I think that this, one of the key things that I like to preach is that, you know, fermentation, particularly in things like sourdough, where you're backslapping or you're continually carrying a culture, is that that's evolution. Right. So you cannot maintain this expectation that your yeast is and your communities are going to remain the same, you know, there. And so in terms of producing or kind of production and kind of societal takeaways, it's that this is an evolutionary practice. And I think in terms of production, it's important to be able to kind of bank communities when you like them, where they're at. And so that you can always return back to them. Cause, you know, it's this balance between, you know, consistency in production, but also, you know, pursuing potential new traits, new phenotypes. And so being able to, I think it's should be part of the practice to be able to preserve, you know, communities where they're at and be able to go back to them or, use them when they're desirable. So that, you know, I think we see this in the kombucha industry a lot where, some, you know, their community will go off the rails and they're not able to bring it back to the product that they were previously able to do a few batches ago. And so I think conventionally we should start practicing kind of microbial hoarding so that we have, you know, backups and
make a backup copy of your manuscript for your thesis, put it on a hard drive and store it at your mom's house in case your dorm burns down. I totally understand.
Exactly.
Totally understand.
Exactly.
So when you're doing all this work in lab and you are going out and buying wine or getting sourdough and culturing it in lab, are you isolating a lot of strains from the fermented foods and then trying to put the communities back together? Or do you select commercial strains and then try to reconstruct these communities?
Yeah. So it's a little bit of both. I have become somewhat of a fermented food hoarder. So every time I, you know, make friends and I'm going over to their house and they tell me they have a sourdough starter, I will, you know, ask for some. And so I have my PI's sourdough starter in the freezer. And so I will collect, you know, these wild cultures and do selective selective plating. So there's a few different things that we can do with it. One of them is selective plating. So being able to grow the yeast specifically on plates that have antibiotics that are preferential for yeast growth, and then being able to isolate those individually and sequence them or bank them. And then same thing with the lactic acid bacteria, we can use like pH sensitive conditions and antifungals to promote the growth of bacteria. So in that way, we're isolating all the kind of individual cultures, but then also we'll do metagenomic sequencing of the whole community. So we will just take the whole community, break it up, isolate the DNA, do the, you know, either the amplicon sequencing of the bacteria or the fungal sequencing to identify really what's in there. Because when you do the culturing, you're most likely going to be losing a lot of the diversity. You're not going to be able to see, you know, the dozens of bacteria that might be in the sourdough starter on the plate. They might look all the same, or, you know, they might not prefer that kind of growth environment. So being able to take a snapshot through the genetics kind of gives you a more clear picture. But for me, so I'm interested in kind of, I'm on the yeast side. So I will take, you know, wines or like grape musts, or, you know, I have a friend who makes tequila. And so they'll bring in, you know, the plant that the agave plant spent must from their fermentation and the juice. And I have isolated the yeast, done all of the amplicon sequencing. And, you know, whenever I, of my personal interest, I, you know, whenever I see that the species is Saccharomyces cerevisiae, you know, then I will pull out that yeast that I had isolated that's now in the freezer, do whole genome sequencing, and then do further genetic variation. So being able to characterize what makes a yeast specifically well suited for, say, tequila production versus the sourdough yeast, or how different are they? In what ways are they different? Can we identify any differential function based off of their evolutionary changes? And then with regard to, I think, kind of precautions, I don't know, working in a yeast lab is relatively safe. It's a BSL, biosafety level one. So it's, you know, there aren't too many safety precautions. You know, you need to autoclave quite a bit to reduce the microbial load of things that, you know, say you're buying grape juice, you need to sterile filter that, autoclave your flowers. But yeah, and in general, we don't really eat anything that we make in the lab. We do, the closest we get is to, like, you know, smelling it, or, you know, we bought an oven to look at the effect of different yeast genetics on bread rise, and we'll quantify how much, you know, a loaf will rise after baking and treat that as a phenotype. But that's usually where I draw the line safety wise.
It must be tough if you are just baking bread all day and you can't touch any of it or have any of it. Yeah, you'll just have to build a separate facility so you can actually start consuming the food.
Exactly. I know.
But I know I've seen social media where you've hosted events where you bake bread and you talk about it. How has your fermentation outreach been going? Can you tell us a little bit about that work?
Yeah, that's been a lot of fun. So I think for me, I have a very deep scientific interest in fermentation for all the reasons that I kind of attributed to at the beginning of this conversation. But I'm very aware that the practice of fermentation and food preservation is anthropological, right? It is related to our survival as a species. And I like being able to go out into the public and share that knowledge and kind of nerd out with whomever wants to know, you know, about the science or the microbiology behind different kinds of fermentations. And so I host local meetups in Los Angeles at breweries. This was inspired by a friend that I had made through the fermentation community, and they do this in New York. And so they do these monthly meetups, and everyone brings a ferment to share. It's kind of a knowledge sharing and a nerding out session that happens once a month. And then on top of that, I am one of the moderators for the fermentation community on Reddit, which is, you know, I think we're at 200,000 subscribers. So it is one of the largest kind of knowledge sharing communities with regard to fermentation practices. And so it feels very humbling to be able to take the insights that I learn in the lab and that, you know, this community generates and take it out and be like, look, we have, you know, we have understood that making sauerkraut or, you know, salt preservation has worked for these reasons. And this is, you know, this is the reason why. These are the microbes responsible. This is, you know, this is how we understand why this is delicious. You know, everything from like sensory mass spectrometry of different flavor profiles and, you know, novel fermentations. It's not something that I want to keep siloed in the academic sphere. And so I'm grateful for outlets like, you know, this podcast and the work that, that you guys collectively are doing to evangelize microbial foods, you know, in a modern way.
I mean, it's also why we're excited to talk to you too. You know, while you've been on these platforms, what is some advice or some information that you learned from Reddit that you were able to take back to the lab with you, or even the other way around, that some insight that you gained working with your sourdough and your model over the past year that might have changed the way in which you bake bread at home now?
Yeah. So Reddit has I have brought my research to Reddit quite a few times, particularly in the sourdough community, and they are insatiable. They have the deepest curiosities, the best questions, the weirdest questions, and they always want more. And I like can't keep up my research fast enough to satiate their interest, but I think things that I've learned from Reddit, outside of the sourdough community, my favorite fermentation community on Reddit is this community called Prison Hooch. And they're kind of the sister community to the fermentation community, and they are extremely experimental. Their whole premise is that they are interested in making alcohol from whatever is possible, from whatever they have on hand. So there are things like, you know, Sour Patch Kids that they will turn into alcohol. They, you know, Mountain Dew, ham glaze, barbecue sauce, and just absolutely like, oh, is there sugar in this? I can make alcohol from it. And it is that level of experimentation, and curiosity, and just like, can I do this? That has really kind of inspired me. And then also the anecdotes that I get, right? So there's so many people out there that are asking about gluten-free starters. You know, can I do this? Because I think that the information is sparse in that space. So like within the sourdough community, they're like, can I use yogurt to inoculate my gluten-free starter? Can I use a regular starter to inoculate my gluten-free starter? And, you know, and I that allows me to bring up the topic of evolution of like, well, you know, if you go from like a whole wheat starter to a gluten-free starter, you're probably not going to maintain the community very well because the carbon source, you know, the maltose that's in the wheat is not going to be the same as what's in teff flour or in rice flour. And so that allows me to kind of nudge more experimentation of like, hey, but there are all these other kind of broader spectrum, more general type, you know, lactic acid bacteria or microbes that you could evolve in these contexts. And then I have people who are like, hey, I got this moldy strawberry and it smelled really good. Like, how do I culture it so I can like make more wine from it? And I'm like, you know, I don't know if I would do that, but like, you could get an agar plate and, you know, grow it. And apparently they did it. And they like came back to me and they're like, it smelled, you know, like this like really complex wine. I'm like, well, you're braver than I am.
Yeah. And, you know, talking about experimentation, if we were to pivot from yeast to filamentous fungi, you recently took what I believe were blue heat Takis and you mixed them with koji.
Yep.
What happened? Can you tell us a little bit about this at-home experiment?
So again, this is like the part of my brand that has been poisoned by the internet. And I have a channel somewhere of like unhinged ferments. And this was one of those things that, you know, like I've been ruined going into the grocery store. I can look at anything and be like, I can ferment that. And so the Blue Heat Takis was one of these that kind of would not leave my brain. And I actually ended up using your mezo recipe as the basis for the blue heat Takis, and I took it to the fermentation meetup I had yesterday. So it's been about a month. I'm trying to probably not ferment it for too long, and I tried it, and it was interesting. It's got, you know, it's still got a little bit of the heat. It's got some of the sweetness from the corn and from the rice koji, but there it's, I'm struggling with what I want to do with it. Part of me thought maybe I'll make a shortbread with it. Cause I kind of want to also preserve, it's bright blue. Like if you've never had these Takis, they are bright blue and the miso itself is bright blue. So I want to be able to kind of showcase the color and whatever I do with it, but it would not make a good miso soup.
One of my long lamented things I never got around to, kind of out of fear, to be honest, back in the fermentation lab at NOMA, me and Kevin, who's still there at NOMA Projects, really wanted to do an April Fool's joke and do like a really long, serious post where we fermented a hot dog with katsuobushi malt. So it went like bluish green and then served it alongside a glass of Coca-Cola kombucha. And he got really close. He's like, "Dean, I got the hot dogs." You know, it's like end of March. And I'm like, I don't think we can do that. I don't think we can post this. But definitely would file under your unhinged ferments category. Maybe I'll come back to it. You've inspired me.
Yeah. The other things that are kind of circling the drain in my brain. Someone has made natto with peanuts, which I think would be kind of cool. And then also, you know, growing koji on like goldfish crackers is up there.
Okay. While the ideas are swirling here, I want to ask you about kind of the big things in the field. You know, if you were given $10 million to start your own lab that was academic versus, you know, similar amount of money to start an R&D branch for a big food company to do interesting things with microbes for new fermented food products that would be, you know, cool for consumers. What are the different directions you would take?
Yeah, I think from a purely academic perspective, I think I would really lean into the evolutionary idea. So this idea of bioprospecting has always kind of intrigued me. So this is this idea of going out into the wild and identifying new species and strains. So, you know, there's concerted efforts to collect. So the evolutionary origins of yeast are currently thought to be in the gut of wasps. So there are people out there kind of catching wild wasps and isolating their gut flora to identify new yeasts. And there are papers where they have done this and made beer and bread and shown that it is actually like commercially viable. So I think this idea of like, you know, collecting and identifying new species or new strains of yeast, I think would be a very interesting academic pursuit. And then, you know, also doing the deep sequencing and characterizing. And, you know, there are labs out there that are doing this all over. But I think I would like to take the population genetics perspective and do, you know, use mapping of traits or use genetic engineering and CRISPR screens to identify the functions so that we, you know, you can identify how different naturally occurring variation contributes to, you know, survival in the wasp gut or survival on an oak tree or all of these kind of natural occurring environments. And then in terms of like industrial interests, I think I would probably lean very heavily onto the genetic engineering synthetic biology side. So there are companies now that are producing things like Sauravisii, which is a yeast that can produce ethanol, but also has the pathway to produce lactic acid. So imagine, you know, so kind of transcending the whole community idea. And, you know, there's this idea of like making a meta microbe that has all of the functional parts of an entire community all put together, which I think would be really interesting. People are doing this for the gut. And I think it'd be really maybe interesting to do this in a food community perspective for the sake of maybe, you know, industrial reproducibility. And again, in that engineering synthetic biology space, I think the area of alternative proteins and kind of mix and matching the production of certain proteins like casein or egg proteins with the right microbe. So, you know, it doesn't even have to be yeast, right? So there are people that are now doing precision fermentation in filamentous fungi, which I think is really cool. So kind of broadly exploring that space.
And where does your current work sit with respect to those two? Like, are you, what's kind of next on the horizon in the near to intermediate term during your postdoc?
That's a great question. So a lot of my work right now is mostly in that evolutionary space. So I'm still working with large collections of genetically diverse yeast and really studying these in very simple phenotypes. So in this case, interaction and growth with bacteria can identify the elements within a yeast genome that promote growth with bacteria in these conditions. And so that hopefully will be a paper in the next year or so. In the big picture, I'm very passionate about the industrial side of things. So I'm planning on kind of transitioning in towards an industrial route, whether that's like working within a food tech company or in kind of the financing space. But it's I don't want to be siloed in the world. As interesting as academia is, I the world is too big.
Awesome. And where can people find out more about you or connect with you? What's a good avenue to keep their eyes on your work?
Yeah. So I own the domain yeast.phd. So hopefully that's easy enough to remember, that you can find all of my links to my socials, including my Reddit profile, the communities I moderate, my Google Scholar profile to follow on kind of the academic pursuits. And yeah. And then if you're in LA, we have a meetup group called LA Ferments that meets once a month. And otherwise, yeah, I'm very accessible on all of the internet.
And then a final question, if we were to open your refrigerator right now and look into it, what sort of fermented food would we see?
So I have two fridges, actually. So I've got we've got the main fridge in the house, but I also am in the kind of the ADU right now, which has a fermentation kitchen, which is just full of all of my fermentation projects. It's got a fair amount of lacto-fermented fruits and vegetables, some fruit changs, some misos. I just started a new batch of kimchi. I've got a lot of vinegars, that one, because I want to take anything that might be going to waste and just add microbes to it to try to preserve that. So I've got a fair amount of like vinegar, or like wine vinegars, fruit vinegars, and pizza dough, cracker dough, kefir cultured butter. Kombucha, all the things.
Listening to you talk about this has both made me hungry, but also hungry for kind of the next phase of research. I think the it's super exciting time to be in this field. To hear you talk about it, I mean, you can hear the passion; it's palpable. So, thanks so much for sharing that with us and joining us for this conversation.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us for our conversation with Chantal Switchko. For more information, visit us at go2.stanford.edu/fermentation series, or just search for Fermentation Speaker Series Stanford on any search engine and sign up for our newsletter. For more conversations like this one, please subscribe on Spotify. If you have any questions, ideas, or comments, we do want to hear from you, so email us at fermentationseries@gmail.com. Music by Sam Fisher. Special thanks to Monica Cryan for her support.